This is Jacob Isbell of the Dignitary Podcast, bringing to you episode 96, Corbett Conversations. James Corbett, welcome to the Dignitary Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to let you know, when I told my wife, I am interviewing James Corbett, she said, "Are you serious?" And I said, "Yes." It's like, "Are you joking with me?" And I said, "No, I'll show you his email right now." And she was so excited, and then she realized that I wasn't talking about Stephen Colbert. And the look of disappointment as she turned to, because I've talked to her about your podcast numerous times, and I think she's watched an episode or two. But she thought I was just on my way to fame and fortune. But I'll tell you what, I couldn't be more excited. Whatever that Colbert guy is, that hack for the shill news, the global industrial complex, everything, give me a hefty helping of James Corbett. How are things in the sunny climes of Japan?
They're pretty sunny today. It's living up to its title. And yes, the funny thing is, I started the Corbett Report in 2007, and it took me about a year before I even realized that this was apparently, in most people's minds, going to be confused with the Colbert Report, of course, right? I didn't think, it didn't even cross my mind that that would happen, because I'm Corbett, not Colbert.
Yeah.
And yet, to this day, I sometimes get emails from people calling me Steven, so.
Well, it's good to have you, and for those of you who have not heard, have not gone to Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com, shame on you, repent right now and go to the website. James is the author of some of the very popular videos like Century of Enslavement Following the Federal Reserve, U.S. Army Prepares to Invade the U.S., 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory, almost a given. You've seen that one because lots of people have taken it upon themselves to re-upload this. Now, James, in reading these titles, people are thinking, well, clearly he's a writer for the Hallmark Channel making feel-good family films. Can I turn it over to you for just a moment? How would you describe the work that you produce?
The work that I produce, well, I think it is described from the outside by a lot of people as conspiracy theorizing. I think I would say that what I'm doing is examining the way power functions in society. And so that takes on a lot of aspects of quote unquote hidden history and things like that. But basically, I do podcasts, I do videos, I do interviews, and I do articles on all sorts of political, social, scientific, historical issues and items, trying to bring some of the suppressed information to the foreground.
Well, we live in a day and age to where the internet makes it so the information is there. I'm going to point out some of my favorite videos that you've produced over the years. The Gladio B series is phenomenal. I have to warn people, it's not an easy bite-sized, give me a mini Snickers sort of thing. I sat down and I watched that series with my digital notepad opened up, taking notes throughout, going throughout it, and it was an eye-opener. The amount of public information regarding U.S. involvement in funding people we claim are our most dangerous enemies is shocking, and I thought I was beyond the point where I could be shocked anymore. A few other episodes that are of great mention, Rockefeller Medicine. A shorter one, Crashes of Convenience, regarding Michael Hastings. That one hit me close to home because, guys, look up Crashes of Convenience. Michael Hastings really came across as a very true believer type journalist, even bringing down the careers of 4-star generals, and his car burst into flames at 4 a.m. In Southern California, and well, clearly there's nothing to investigate inside of here, and he's only a year older than myself. Who is Graham Fuller? Only 11 minutes right there, and the questions that it leaves you asking. Some of the great series, 9/11 Suspects series, numerous different ones on that, and the one I am likely to do a lot of follow-up with in our conversation today, 9/11 Follow the Money. What I wanted to throw at you, James, these kind of ones that I've mentioned are more than just some of your podcasts and some of your short news coverage. These ones take a bit of production. What's production time like for these kind of things that I mentioned?
It's funny that you bring that up, because I am not in the midst, I guess at the end of a new documentary that is just about to be released. And so I've been in the midst of this for months now, the production of the latest version. Thankfully, now I have a video editor who is in Australia who does my editing for me, so I don't have to worry about the video side of it. And if I did, I probably wouldn't be able to do nearly as much as I do. So big thanks to Brock West in Australia for that. But yes, for a long time, I was doing all the video editing and everything myself. So it was an incredible amount of work to get this all together. And so it involves not only, of course, the research, which in some ways is a years-long process for each and every one of these big documentary projects. But then, of course, the writing, you know, whittling it down to the storyline. And then there's the editing and going back and forth. And, well, what do we put here? What do we put there? Can this go in here? And then you get to the point of the recording, the audio, and then the video editing, and then mastering all of that, and finally getting it launched. And it's an incredibly detailed process. So, yeah, for these longer documentary projects, it can take several months, really, to put them together.
There's a TEDx talk that you gave that I very much appreciated. You talk about your awakening there in Japan. Can I have you give a short version of things? What were the first things that made you say, wait a second, this doesn't fit in with what my worldview is? And what led to your awakening?
Well, my awakening, as it's called, which is a problematic term in a lot of ways, but I'm assuming at least some of your audience can
we're cultish, aren't we?
Yeah, it does sound awakening. A bit cultish, doesn't it?
But tell us about your step into the light.
Well, there is a real phenomenon that happens when people start encountering some very unusual information they truly didn't expect, and it can be very disorienting at first. So I think a lot of people can probably relate to that. And my experience with that happened in 2006. So basically, I was in Japan. I was teaching English. The furthest thing from my mind was starting a website, getting involved in anything like this. I had absolutely no intention to do so. But I moved into a new apartment here in Japan, and this apartment came with an internet connection. It would be the first time I'd had internet in my apartment for years. So I suddenly had internet, and hey, I could just sit and browse it at home at my leisure. And there's all these nifty new services that had popped up in the meantime, like YouTube, like Google Video. These were brand new things back in 2006. So I was doing what I tended to do. Hey, I like to watch documentaries. I like to find out information. Hey, I can watch pretty much anything I want, that's as long as it's on YouTube or Google Video. And at that time, it was the Wild West, so everything was on YouTube and Google Video. So it was great for me. I was learning all sorts of new stuff, but I kept getting these related videos recommended to me in the sidebar about 9/11 conspiracy stuff. And I thought, oh no, I didn't even want to hear it. I didn't want to see it. That's stupid. It's ridiculous. Look, I know there's conspiracies and things that happen, but 9/11, that's just ridiculous. Once in a while, I'd click out of one of them just out of morbid curiosity or just to laugh at the stupidity of it. And to be fair, there were some stupid videos being promoted about flying orbs and things like this. But every once in a while, there'd be a clip from a documentary or something that caught my attention. And I thought, well, that cannot be the case. I can't believe that. And I'd go and look up the little nugget of information.
There's no way that's the official story.
Right, yeah. Well, I'd go and look up this little nugget of information that was being told to me in a documentary, and I'd find, oh my God, there's actual proof of it. For example, Operation Northwoods. There was this plan that went through that the Joint Chiefs of Staff were sitting there on the president's desk in 1962 waiting to be signed. That was a whole series of events that were going to be staged in order to justify an invasion of Cuba. They were talking about sinking ships or taking down airliners or starting terrorist incidents, blowing things up, killing people in Washington, D.C. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff signed off on this, and it was waiting for Kennedy's signature. Kennedy didn't sign it, and so it never went ahead. But it's very interesting, that little piece of history, and how we don't get taught that in school, even though it's been known about for a couple of decades at this point. Anyway, it's been declassified. So that was the kind of information that I started to find, and I started to go, well, that I didn't know that. I didn't hear that on the 9 o'clock news, or sometimes there even was things that were literally on the mainstream news that just kind of got memory hold somehow. Like, Osama bin Laden was in Rawalpindi in a military hospital on the night before 9/11. 100%. The U.S. military and intelligence services knew where Osama bin Laden was on the night before 9/11, and yet somehow he got away. And then Tora Bora, and he somehow got away. What's going on here? So the more I started to dig into it, basically it was the snowball that was rolling downhill. Once you start trying to search this information in order to disprove it, and you have a tough time disproving it, you start getting into that process. And it was really just, you know, it was just a process that kept going. And I started finding out the Federal Reserve and the monetary system and things along that those lines. And by that point, I guess I was ready to start my own website to continue the research for myself and do it in a very public fashion.
It's been years that you've been publishing stuff. And I'd have to say, you don't look like, oh, this is the face that we expect to be prominent and to be meaningful. I'll pay you a compliment. And I don't do these sort of compliments just because you're my guest. These are really the value that I know myself and many others see. You put formidable show notes, almost as if a challenge. I'm hoping some of this can be proven wrong and allow other people to take it on themselves. I already know just the items that you've put out. Some people are going to be in this conversation. They're going to say, there's no way that's there. I'm putting inside of my show notes links to your episodes in the hopes that the worldview that you have and that I have can be proven to be false. That would be very comforting. Well, let me ask you, if you went through something similar, myself having that sort of process to where, wait, you mean we're not just the good guys? I've always felt that we're the good guys. My papa's a military veteran. He volunteered for the army during Vietnam era, thankfully didn't have to go and fight in live combat there. Well, red, white, and blue, apple pie, and everything else. I'm a member of a respectable society. And it was difficult having these moments to where, you mean we've really done this? We've really killed this many people? You realize they did it in my name? And I've never been taught this? And I've never had respectable adults inside of my life that I've loved and respected who tried to convey this to me in my youth? And it was painful. And one of the ways that I would go back, I would watch puppy videos or kitten videos. And I'm not, it's kind of funny to say, but it's like, I got to decompress. I got to take it a moment away from this. And I've got spiritual beliefs and things of that nature that I would hold on to. But I realized this hurts, but I'm determined to know what's true, no matter how bad it hurts. Did you go through something similar?
Of course. I mean, as I say, it was very disorienting when I started encountering this information. I wasn't looking for it. I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't trying to find it. It just kind of came out. And the more research I did, the more I found that it was the case. And I think what you're pointing to is actually, in a way, kind of the hopeful side of this, is that yourself and the members of your family and others are clearly not involved in some big plot, conspiracy plot to try to, you know, subjugate the world or whatever. They're well-meaning people who genuinely do want what's best for their family and their friends and don't want to try to inflict harm on others if they can help it. But they're used by this system and fed up and spat out by it. As need be, as of course a lot of vets ultimately find out when they try to get their medical bills taken care of or their medical care taken care of when they come back from the meat grinder and find that Uncle Sam doesn't seem to care about us so much anymore. So I think in a way that's a hopeful thing, that the most of the people that we do relate to in our day-to-day lives are just regular people trying to get by, not trying to get, you know, get one over on everyone else. But unfortunately, it also means that a clique of people in positions of power can use our good intentions and our well-meaningness against ourselves and against other people around the world. And that's the unfortunate side of it, which is why I think information exposing the machinations of people in those positions of power to the light is the important part. Fundamentally important part of what we do, because when the mass of people know about what is going on, I don't think they can be so easily duped into going along with an agenda that they don't support. And that's why I think a lot of this information is kept from us when we're younger, and when we're forming our viewpoint of you know, what the world is and where we stand in it.
Here's some of the things that make me very hopeful. As I learn about Stalin Russia in the 1950s, and I learn about other oppressive regimes, there was the ability to crack down on the free flow of information. And I even speaking to an Iranian man, he was telling me about back in the day when they were trying to have their revolution, they'd have to get these audio cassettes and make so many copies and spread them out. And there had to be that kind of fighting back at spreading information. The uncomfortable conversations that you're involved in, and I try to be involved in as well, and many others. Anybody can say, wait a second, press that pause, do a search on the internet. Wow, I can see where this one's going very quick. There's not the ability to shut down the free flow of information without really revealing a tyrannical nature. And I don't believe that those in power are willing to expose themselves that much because it's been such an incremental kind of crackdown on freedoms, dumbing down of society in general. But I feel like you and I are on the side that will inevitably win just because time is on the side of truth. And in this day of free flow of information, it would be very difficult to be able to put an end to that or even slow it down.
I think you're right. And I don't want to come across as if I am the way, the truth, and the light, and I have everything 100% perfect. As you were saying before, the show notes that I do, the comprehensive show notes that I do for everything I produce is, in a sense, a challenge. But in a sense, it's fundamental to what I do, the open source nature of this. Here's all the different pieces that I use to construct what I'm talking about. Here, please take a look at them, you know, put them together with your own experience. I think it's all of us doing that together is what's going to come at the truth. It's not going to be one person who's going to put this all together. So that's what I'm trying to do. And I think what you're saying is ultimately we now have this incredible technology in our hands to communicate with each other instantaneously around the world through all these different means and share information. And that process is truly a revolutionary process.
I might edit this guy out, but say hi, James.
Hi, James.
Hi.
you go back inside, my buddy. I'm going to talk to my buddy, James. I'll leave that in. What you saw there, what you saw there is the reason I do it. You got two of them now?
Yes, I do.
And if you're anything like me, it changes your worldview. It's because I'm lucky enough, mom and dad that have loved me, taught some significant values, some significant moral standards that have brought me into adulthood without having to learn a lot of lessons the hard way and realize, okay, I got this little guy now. I feel that weight to be right there. Lots of people like to accuse people that think like you and myself, especially if they hear the word anarchist, you mean your political philosophy is anarchy? They use that word to say, you guys just want everybody to be on your own. And I'm left saying, where in the world did you get that idea? I don't know of any philosophy more dependent upon reaching out to people on a voluntary basis and say, hey, it's worthwhile to talk to me, James Corbett. Hopefully I can supply you with a meaningful conversation and we can bring some information out that people can tune into because there's no way for me to force them to listen to this in a government indoctrination education system.
Yes, and that's an important point. Unfortunately, anarchism has become such a tainted word because there's so many different people who apply it in so many different ways, and you have everything from MCOM to NCAP and million flavors.
Hollywood's not going to put out a movie that has an anarchist theme unless there's a lot of Molotov cocktails involved.
Exactly right. You gotta have the beard. Well, I have that. You probably have to have a beret, and you got to throw Molotov cocktails. So
we're doing all right there. What do you say we peel back the layers of this onion? I will do my best to be traffic cop right now. What I want to do, I want to pick your brains a little bit. You and I have had at least, I'm sure, different roads, but kind of a similar sort of awakening. The worldview that many people still have, and at least had prior to the attacks of 9/11, is the United States is the good guys. We're fighting for freedom throughout the world. That's what red, white, and blue is all about. And when we got hit on 9/11, that's clearly the bad guys attacking the good guys and nothing else in between. First thing that I want to throw at you is a term that has finally made it into regular mainstream media discourse: false flag. If you had to point to somebody who says there's no way that the United States would be involved in something to where we allow ourselves to be attacked or heaven forbid, actually created ourselves, what's something that would pop into your mind? Would you say, investigate this? You might have already mentioned it in this conversation.
Well, 9/11 would be an obvious example along those lines in the post 9/11 age. But if we wanted to go before 9/11, I think one that's particularly fascinating to me is the OKC bombing from 1995. That is one where clearly whatever really did happen there, and I don't claim to know down to the details of what did happen and who did what, but I know 100% that the story we've been told about the OKC bombing is not the story that that took place on that day. And there's so many different aspects to that that I've gone over in some of my other work before. I did a documentary called The Secret Life of Timothy McVeigh, which talks about some of his very strange and interesting connections with Army Special Forces and Nichols, Terry Nichols, saying that he was being directed by a man from the FBI and all of this kind of stuff that was going on surrounding that event. And you have informants from the ATF and others talking about what was happening in the weeks leading up to that blast and having cased the site and with other men that they identified, including this Andreas Strassmeier, who is some German intelligence guy working with the CIA. It gets crazier and crazier. And as I say, I don't claim to know the final truth of what happened, but I know that the government is actively withholding information that would help us to even start to approach what that truth is, including the video that was absolutely recorded on, that there was a camera on the Alfred P. Murrah building that morning, April 19th, 1995, that recorded the Ryder truck pulling up, recorded not one, but two men getting out of the Ryder truck at different times, Timothy McVeigh and John Doe number two, who you might remember because he was the subject of what at the time was the largest manhunt in FBI history. Dozens of witnesses seeing another person in the Ryder truck with Timothy McVeigh that morning. And, well, we couldn't find him. Oh, I guess he didn't exist. And the videotape of the Murrah building bombing, which people have seen, they interviewed on the local news in Oklahoma City saying, yeah, we've seen the tape and it shows the man getting out. That tape clearly in the possession of the FBI, not shown at McVeigh's trial. And now that people have been suing the FBI in court to try to get that evidence out, the FBI says, we've looked and looked, but we can't find it. So oh, that tape's just missing.
Don't we love it when it's so convenient that way?
Yeah. So that's a particularly interesting case for me because, again, there's so many layers to that onion that people may have one or two of the bits of that information that, oh, yeah, I think I remember hearing about that. But when you put it all together, it's clearly something very different than what we were told. And again, it's the exact same, it's the same idea as something like 9/11, just on a more manageable scale. 9/11, obviously, such a huge event and so incredibly scarring for many people in their psyche. So perhaps OKC has a little less of that emotional resonance that people can actually go with a bit of a cleaner slate to take a look at the evidence.
Here's what you do quite well with your 5-minute video, 9/11, a conspiracy theory. Key the orchestral classical music and we hear your voice come on in and you point out in less than 5 minutes what is the official story, and people hear the absurdity of it and they say to themselves, wait, that's what I believe? And they're left with that. So when people take a look at, well, what is the official story of the OKC bombing or anything else? This is the official story. There's no way that fits. I don't believe in these conspiracy theories. Well, why is it that you don't ask questions when you know the official story is clearly not the most accurate one? Let me throw one idea at you. Please tell me, because we might have to end this this conversation early if you haven't seen this movie, The Princess Bride.
I have, but it's been decades, so I don't remember it as well as everyone else seems to.
Because if you simply said no, I would have said, thank you very much for being on the program. So you've got Prince Humperdinck, and of course he weds Princess Buttercup, and he's describing to his to one of his minions who's now involved in torturing Wesley, say, I've got so much to do. I've got my wife to kill and Galdar to blame for it and the army to invade. And it's a joke and it's a passing comment. I'm going to assassinate a prominent figure, point my finger as the excuse to invade, as the pretext to invade my enemies. And we go, ha, ha, ha. We laugh at it and say, wow, this is just fiction. It's so easy to see in history. We don't question it when we see the history of it. Let me ask, why is it that people have such a hard time believing it when the evidences are in front of us today?
I think because most people don't want to deal with the implications of such a thing. Because obviously, if we have been lied to about such fundamental things and about such important things, then the question is, well, how on earth, why, I mean, A, why did we fall for it? But B, more importantly, perhaps, rather than victim blaming, how about blaming the perpetrators? Who are these perpetrators? And in the case of something like 9/11, that's still relatively recent, some of those people are still in corridors of power. And that would be a pretty uncomfortable thing for a lot of people to really deal with. And so I think there are so many mental barriers to get erected around this issue, which is why I think it is important to look at the historical examples of false flag terrorism, and there are plenty, because again, there's less of those emotional and mental barriers around that, especially when you're talking about other countries and other times in history. When you talk about Sweden at one point, in order to gin up a war with Russia, had some, literally, the king of Sweden had the Opera House tailors actually sew a bunch of Russian military uniforms for the Swedish soldiers to dress up in so that they could then attack other Swedish soldiers as Russians in order to gin up a war. Sounds ridiculous, but most people have never heard about this. They don't know anything about, you know, 18th century Swedish-Russian relations. So it's the kind of thing you can just examine the evidence and you can just see, oh, that's crazy. And you can get the idea as a concept in that sense. But when you're suddenly thrust into it in the middle of, oh, you know, 9/11 was an inside job, that's deep end material for most people who have never even heard of the concept. So I think it's important to have that historical understanding so that we know that it's ridiculous to think this tactic has been used over and over and over and over and over throughout history, but we're in a special bubble of history where no one would ever think to do that, right?
Well, let me point out the common thread that I've seen in trying to analyze what is this? What is the common theme? It has to do with power and consolidation of power. Whether it's a low-tech time in history, whether it's a high-tech time in history, people are moving towards that consolidation of power. We see, while the bodies are still warm inside of the rubble of the 9/11 attacks, you have legislation, the Patriot Act, and other actions taking place to say, there's no time to ask questions. Put the power in our hands. Otherwise, we will shame you to never be elected, and you will never be a part of polite society unless you give us this power right now. Very few principled people like Ron Paul are willing to say, no, I'm not on board with this. When I take a look at Operation Northwoods, you have competing world powers saying, no, we want to consolidate it so there's not that balance of another world power inside the world. When you take a look at the global warming, which is now changed to climate change debate, the solutions that we have all turn into consolidation of power into our hands. That's the biggest warning for me. Maybe there's some merit to this thing or that thing, but when you're proposing solutions that concentrate power into those who have already been abusing it for generations, I'm not on board with that. And I think there's clearly a lot more to be investigated.
I think you're right about that. And I think you touched on what is really the fundamental issue of all of this, which is so what we were talking about earlier, this incredible technology that we have now to communicate with each other and to be peer-to-peer connected to people all around the world in networks of interest that can do things like research historical events or whatever, come together for a million different reasons in a million different ways. That is decentralization. We are taking out the need for the middlemen that existed in previous eras where all we had was these mass media communication technologies where you had to be a billionaire owning a media conglomerate in order to, you know, print newspapers or whatever in order to get your message out to a million people. Now you can be like me, a guy sitting in his living room in Japan making videos that are seen by a million people. It's incredible. It's mind-blowing. It's absolutely, completely game-changing in terms of the way power is structured and functions in our society. So what are the people in the positions of that centralized power going to do other than fight back as hard as they can against the decentralization. They want to consolidate control, not decentralize it. And I think it's an historical phenomenon that we're living through. It is the attempt to decentralize, or not even the attempt, just the fact that we are now becoming decentralized, because I think that's natural. We want to relate to other people directly. We don't need to go through these national governments or anything else as intermediaries and middlemen. The technology is finally allowing us to be able to do that. But what are people in positions of power going to do? They're going to try to go the other way. They're going to try to centralize, control, consolidate. And that's why this war on terror narrative, for example, is a very convenient narrative for all power and authority institutions everywhere in the world. Because now every government anywhere in the world has the carte blanche to declare their enemies as terrorists. If you are not going along with what we want, you're a terrorist, and now we have the reason to clamp down on you. And that's exactly, of course, what is happening, starting to happen now with regards to the internet and the free flow of information on the internet, because people can be radicalized with information on the internet, i.e. they can find out things the government doesn't want the people to know about. And as a result, well, we have to make sure we can control and make sure people can't communicate quite as freely, and we have to have these bodies, these YouTubes and Googles and Facebooks and everything, clamping down on information. So I think it's just a historical phenomenon. It's the fighting of two different opposing trends. I think the historical winner in this is ultimately going to be decentralization, but it's going to be one hell of a fight.
There's a number of things that you make pop into my mind every time that you speak. Here's a couple of things. I went to go see Medieval Times over in Anaheim, California. And if you haven't seen that, just type in Medieval Times Cable Guy onto a YouTube search and you'll see Matthew Broderick and Jim Carrey. When I was there at Medieval Times, they simply say, all right, this section of this indoor arena with horses and knights and everybody else, you guys are going to root for the blue knight. You guys are going to root for the green knight, and you guys the red knight, you guys the white knight. And we boo and we hiss and we watch this amazing drama play out. And I'll tell you what, I was in the blue section when my guy was up there. I felt the fervor and I rooted for him. Even though I knew this is a show, there's a predetermined victor, and I had the willing suspension of my disbelief as I enjoyed that. I compare that to what we see today. You're either going to vote for Donald Trump or else you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. Can you get two more dislikable and the perceivable, like the American mindset in general? These are despicable people. Democrats in general dislike Hillary Clinton. Republicans in general dislike Donald Trump. And we're told anything beyond that, you're not in the arena. You're not rooting for the blue knight or the red knight like you're supposed to. I wanted to at least get that thought out. Let me throw out one more before I turn it over to you. People love House of Cards. I'm enjoying it. And they see the sociopathic, homicidal power seekers in a dramatic environment. And, ooh, we love the drama. We soak it in. Holy cow, this is such good writing. But there's no way that this is happening today. Let me know if you've seen any of the episodes of House of Cards and if you think they are underplaying corruption or overplaying corruption.
Actually, I'm proud to say that I haven't watched any TV series in over a decade and a half. So
that's why you're so. I have not. That's why you're so productive, James Corbett. This is why you can produce things. Let me at least throw it to you. I'm spoiler alert. I mean, if you haven't watched it, then I just don't care. So I'm going to spoil it for you anyway. Francis Underwood. You see that this is somebody on his way to becoming vice president and becoming president, kills people along the way. He clearly has a separate life. It's not really any spoilers. He's going to kill people to get power, and he's going to end up becoming president. And really, people love the drama. They say it's amazing writing. It's clearly great dramatic stuff if you're into that. James Corbett, you just keep watching documentaries because we need this production from you. But I guess let me throw it to you. Here's the point at which people start to become uncomfortable. Do people in the top rungs of American power and power throughout society today, do they kill one another for more power?
The short answer is yes. Yes, they do. And I think the way that most people can at least get their heads around the concept is through the monetary idea that there are, I mean, if people are willing to do crazy things for hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars in our day-to-day life with the people that we know, that that we interact with. Well, what about when there are millions of dollars on the line? What about when there are billions of dollars? What about when there are trillions of dollars on the line? And that, that is a concept that you and I obviously cannot relate to, but that is a real thing that exists in the world. There are entire industries that are structured around certain things that can go one way or another, depending on who's in positions of political power to enact this or that piece of legislation or to make this or that invasion occur. Do you really believe, in your heart of hearts, do you really believe that there are people who would not be willing to kill in order to make sure things go one way instead of another way? I think everyone, when they really interrogate it, can admit to themselves that, yes, there are people in this world who absolutely would kill for power to make a certain decision go a certain way to ensure that they get whatever it is they're looking for. And so we can understand it from the monetary side of things. I think that there's actually... there's even deeper levels than that. I think there are people who are not so motivated by the monetary side of it so much as ideological and power side of it. And then you have to throw in the whole psychopathy angle and the fact that there are people who genuinely have a different brain structure than the average person, a couple of percentage points of the population, who literally do not feel the emotion that you and I feel, do not feel sympathy for other human beings, do not understand, recognize, or process other human beings as actual beings, people with lived experience that should be taken account of. And when you start to add all of that together, you start to get the picture that, yes, there is a reason why politicians are so disliked in our current age. There is a reason why politicians are so universally famous for being conniving and backstabbing and lying and mealy-mouthed and all of that. It's because those are the types of people who are attracted to those positions of power. And then there's the other layer behind them of the people who put those people into positions of power, the bankers and others who fund these types of different communities. So there's a lot to it, but I think people can at least understand that much, that when you have these positions of power which can make decisions that can direct entire industries, deals that are larger than you and I could ever even comprehend hinge on these decisions, these things aren't left to chance. And I think people can at least wrap their head around that idea.
I think they can. They can wrap it around to where, hey, there's the monetary incentive, there's the power incentive. Let me throw out a term that you had taught me. It was in your documentary, Political Pedophilia. You brought up the term kakistocracy, and you mentioned it again now, not to be confused with kakistocracy, which is the underbelly of the internet worshiping a frog, but kakistocracy. Can you give a description of what that means and possibly in relationship to how there may be sociopathic rule?
Kakistocracy is the opposite of aristocracy. Aristocracy technically means rule by the best. The idea being that, of course, the aristocrats, the nobles, are just inherently better people, and that's why they rule. Well, At any rate, kakistocracy is the opposite concept. It is rule by the worst, rule by the least qualified, rule by the most vile. And I think that is a pretty apt description of a lot of the systems that we find ourselves governed by in this day and age. Of course, people who are trapped in that red versus blue paradigm that you were talking about earlier will say, well, yes, that's the other side, but that's not our side. And then people on the other side of that divide will say, that's your side, that's not our side. But perhaps if you can step back for a second and see the system for what it is essentially a kakistocracy, which there are different ways of, again, conceptualizing this, but I think one particularly interesting way is to look at the idea of a pathocracy, where people who get into positions of power from which they can, for example, determine who else is going to sit and who's going to sit on this board, who's going to get into this committee or things along those lines, people with actual decision-making abilities. If you get a few people in those positions that themselves are psychopaths, are people who are bloodthirsty and ruthless and willing to stab people in the back in order to get ahead, well, they start to recruit other people who are at least amenable to those ideas, if not actually reflective of them themselves. And that becomes a type of cancer that invades the body politic, as it were, and perpetuates itself. And that creates a kakistocracy, whereby if you are not evil. If you do not have blackmailable material or some sort of dirt that can be used against you, then you don't get into those positions of power. And from that point, it starts to fester and it looks like an open wound, which is unfortunately what a lot of the governments around the world look like to me today. I see that process having played out for, well, I mean, in the United States case, we can be quite specific, at least since 1947 with the passage of the National Security Act, which created a sort of government within the government. The obviously gave birth to the CIA in 1948, and the structure of the intelligence agencies right now that are finally being identified in the mainstream media as the deep state, which is a concept that's been around for a while, but finally sort of starting to penetrate public consciousness, again, only in that red-blue game. But at least people are starting to get the idea that there is a kind of ruling class that does abide. It stays through administration after administration, no matter whether it's the red or the blue team in power. There are certain clique that live in these special cloistered segments of the government that have national security clearance and things like this that somehow survive and can manipulate events from behind the scenes.
Well, it just can't be denied the same way. Again, if we're living just 2 decades ago, you and I were both alive 2 decades ago. And I would have understood these concepts as a teenager, but there wasn't the ability to say, hey, how can I find a verifiable source to see this is there? There's dedicated people in each decade that will put out some well-researched books, but it's a matter of where you're going to find this book. It's not like you can just order it off of Amazon, have it at your door in a couple of days. So lots of dedicated people, at least they can have their stuff put in PDF format. It's there. A couple of things that people can wrap their heads around very easily. Kakistocracy, rule by the worst. Watch James Corbett, and I'm going to plug you a bunch because you're worth plugging. James Corbett's Political Pedophilia, because it'll detail not only Jimmy Savile, but many other people who were at the top ranks of power, walking hand in hand, being inside the offices, giving advice to British royalty, as well as American top politicians, and you realize these are sexual deviant predators who traffic in children. And you and people who hear that, holy crap, there's no way it can be that. And you realize this is a matter of established public record. And whether it is Oliver Stone puts out his movie JFK with big Hollywood actors, so now, oh, finally there's enough awareness. And we're going to say, okay, we'll release some stuff after such and such a year. But these certain pages, you're just never going to find ever again. Oh, Jimmy Savile, we could have prosecuted him years earlier. In fact, law enforcement was ready to take action. Why didn't they? And you see the delays, the retractions, the dragging the feet. And you can't help but say, hey, is there something closer to the inside that's nefarious? And that's where, for somebody like myself, I want to know the truth. I want to know what is it that we can verify. Some things can't be verified, but there's beyond more than just a couple of dots that implicate things. There's some pretty nefarious things at work that indicate those who are in power and those who are being directed by those who are really in power, they are not like you and I. You've already mentioned, I cry tears of joy on somewhat of a regular basis, because I got 2 little ones and hopefully more in the future. And it means a lot. I go to church. I work with young teenagers and I see their progress, their growth, their moral standards, their forming communities. And that's meaningful. I'm familiar with some of your work in Japan and in teaching people. And you're part of a stable culture where there's a family environment. And to think, are we really not ruled by people who have those common values instilled within them?
It's almost impossible to encounter the really dark material that I do cover without understanding that this is clearly not coming from people who are structured like you and me, or the people that we relate to on a daily, day-to-day basis. Again, it might be impossible for people to even wrap their minds around the concept, because like yourself, like myself, we have children, we work with children, we see the incredible opportunities that are there for this brimming life, the energy that is in these children that are hungry to see and encounter the world. And of course, the idea of of abusing that trust or using it in nefarious ways is
or not being horrified.
It's impossible.
I mean, just the idea to where, like, if because people can have their fall from graces, have their awful moments, and at least the idea that somebody would be horrified at their actions and maybe they're redeemable because there's the real remorse, to realize that there's people to where they just don't feel it, do not have the ability to feel pain for when they do something wrong. So those of you who are hearing the audio only, James is holding, hold it up one more time for me, holding up political penurology. Give me a quick rundown.
Ponerology.
Ponerology.
Ponerology is the study of evil in politics.
Okay.
And Political Ponerology is a book that was written by Andrew Lobachevsky. And it's a remarkable story of a Polish researcher living in communist Poland who was researching the idea of pathocracy, psychopathy, doing real research into scientific research into what, you know, how this functions and then how this functions in political spheres. Obviously not that popular in communist Poland. So he had his manuscript that he'd been working on, compiling his data and his research got destroyed. He had to recreate it from scratch, smuggle it out of Poland. This is the result. It's a book called Political Ponerology. I highly recommend
hold it one more time.
People who are interested.
Am I seeing Donald Rumsfeld on there?
Yes. This is obviously a new edition of, yeah, of the book with, you know, that relates to our time. But for people who are interested in this subject and how it works, this is a fascinating thing. And it's hard scientific data about psychopathy and how it functions and how many people are affected and what the psychopathic mind is like. It's a way of trying to get our heads around this concept, which, again, for most people, you want to assume that, you know, it's the people out there, you see other people, you think, well, they're kind of like me. Maybe they have different thoughts or ideas or experiences, but they're kind of like me. They're well-meaning. They're well-intentioned. Well, there are people out there who are not well-meaning and not well-intentioned and really do not care about inflicting pain. In fact, actually desire to inflict pain and suffering on other people, which is a fundamental thing to understand. And if we do not understand it, then we perish for the lack of that knowledge, because we can, as I say, entire systems can be built up around people who are well-intentioned and well-meaning and not out to cause harm to others. That puts them in a system in which they end up causing harm to others. And if they do not understand how and why they're being manipulated and by whom, then what chance do they have of ever putting a stop to that process?
I will probably do a book review on a book that I just finally finished that I should have read as a teenager, but I didn't. The Gulag Archipelagos. I'm going to butcher his last name, Solzhenitsyn.
Solzhenitsyn?
I'll put it in the show notes because I'm not going to say it right. But when you're pointing out, hey, we expect people to have somewhat similar experiences. If I see a young mom or a dad and they got a little kid crying, I naturally start to feel some things in common. Maybe some of the frustrations, maybe a little bit of smile on my face. Oh, I know what that's like. Or if I simply feel an acquaintance that I haven't even heard from in years, maybe somebody from high school, and I hear they got a child that's sick or that passed away. Oh, goodness. You and I and probably everybody that's willing to listen to this conversation, they feel some pain inside of them because there's a level of humanity that we have in common. And I think if there's anything that we get from this conversation, realize it is dangerous to remain ignorant that others who may be in charge don't feel the human love that connects us. The kind of human love that, so we don't need guns to rule one another, but we're able to defend ourselves from those who might harm us, but build meaningful connections and communities. I want to throw the last thought to you, James. What is it that makes you hopeful? And even making a two-part question, what makes you hopeful and what is it that you plan to strive for over the course of these next 5 and 10 years?
Well, what makes me hopeful is what we've touched on before, the idea that this decentralization that is happening now is an historical inevitability. It is happening, and it is being enabled through this technology, but the technology is just an expression of our desire as human beings to connect to other people and to function and work in communities and groups. And that's the other side of the anarchism that you were talking about earlier. People think of, you know, bomb throwers and whatever, but no, anarchism is about people coming together in communities to take care of each other. And I do think that is ultimately the destiny of humanity. It's a pretty tall order. And as I say, the powers of centralization and control are going to kick and fight and put up, well, one hell of a fight to try to resist that. So it's, I think, our duty to be at least informed about what is happening and why it is important for us to understand these issues in greater detail. So that is, of course, what ultimately I'm planning to do for the next 5 or 10 or 20 or however many years it takes. This is a generational project. I'm under no delusions about that. And ultimately, probably the most important thing I can do is to raise my children in a way that they understand these issues and that they can grow up strong. And that doesn't mean me telling them what to believe or telling them how the world works. It is me showing them the process by which they can understand the world for themselves. And if I can do that, then I consider my work to be done. And if everyone can do that, to teach children to think for themselves, to understand, to be able to take in and process and analyze information, discard information that's clearly not correct, doesn't accord with reality, and to keep the information that does, then I don't think a world full of independent thinkers who are capable of analyzing information can be controlled in the ways the populations have been controlled in the past. So that's the ultimate goal, I think, ultimately. But in terms of my work on the website, it's continuing to give information that challenges people's beliefs and conceptions and misconceptions and preconceptions. And that's always an uphill struggle. And you're always going to run into people's mental barriers around whatever issues that they have in their own lives. So I understand that. And it's what I have to continue finding ways to do. And that's why I'm pretty excited about this new documentary I've worked on for the last several months. It's really the culmination in some ways of the last 10 years of research that I've been doing. It is incredibly broad in terms of its scope and what I'm trying to convey, the story that I'm trying to tell in this documentary. But I think it has the potential, at any rate, to really open a few doors and get people's thinking in about the bigger picture. And that's ultimately what it's about, because I find as the years go on, I'm less interested in the day-to-day flow of news events than I am in the bigger picture, because I think we lose sight of the forest for all the trees that we encounter along the way. So I'm trying to sort through, take a step back, take a picture of the forest, and try to convey that to other people.
Let me have you please shamelessly plug this documentary, the name, when it will be out, and where we can find it.
Oh, you're trying to trick me into revealing it all before it comes out. No. I'm just going to tell people, go to CorbettReport.com and... I hate to put a date to it. Okay. I am hoping and planning to get it released this Friday, which, if my calendar serves me correctly, will be September 29th. But don't hold me to that. Okay. I reserve the right to be a few days late, but it is coming very soon, so please stay tuned to CorbettReport.com.
James Corbett, if I had another 3 hours with you, I would keep it going on, but I want to say thank you so much for being on the Dignitary Podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you and to your audience.
About destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? But you know it's gonna be